Hey everybody, welcome to the spoiler edition for this week's episode of Game of Thrones. It's 6:04, Book of the Stranger.
Sounds like 6:04 to me.
Yeah, I've got a summer cold, which if you've seen Metalocalypse, you know is just the worst. Which now that I think about it, I think I made that same fucking joke this time last year on my solo cast. So it's like something about Game of Thrones makes me ill. I don't know whether it's the stress of the three podcasts a week or just I don't something about this changing the seasons, but I come down with a goddamn spring summer cold every year at this time. But no one gives a shit. I will persevere. Just know that I'm heavily medicated. I'm operating about 3 hours of sleep.
Well, that's your own damn fault.
No, man. I fucked up my shoulder kayaking 2 weeks ago.
That's right.
And so every time I turn over on my left side, I am awoken, even with my fantastic Casper bed. and I also, every 3 hours, my nose completely decides to stop working, and I wake up gasping for breath. So it's not all my fault. I'm trying. Also, fuck you. So I want to talk about some Kingsmoot stuff, because people have been asking about the Kingsmoot. How is the Kingsmoot going to go? And I actually have been stalling because I had forgotten a lot of details myself. So I did a bit of research. The Kingsmoot, by law, and all this, the double Ds could change or shuffle up as they... There's a couple things that are interesting. It's held on Old Wick, which was one of the smallest of the Iron Islands, on a place called Naga's Hill. Now, Naga is the name of a supposed ancient sea dragon that Iron Islanders revere. In fact, on this hill, there's what's said to be the bones of Naga, like its rib cage jutting up from the ground, like it's was beached and buried there. Mm-hmm. But the way they describe it in the books is very similar to like the way they describe other like stone dragons, where it's like, you know, this could be a bunch of like essentially giant driftwood or rock formations. It's not conclusive that it's you know, it's not like, oh shit, this is dinosaur bones and we've dug them up and we've done analysis and put together a skeleton and this is a no shit sea dragon. It's more like that's just 8,000 years ago this sea dragon died here and yada yada. But I'm curious to see when we get to this Old Wick set and in the Kingsmoot whether they'll include any of those details or not, because you know there's lots of dragons. We're going to be talking about a few different types this podcast, and having a sea dragon kicking around would be kind of cool. The other interesting detail is I mentioned that the Iron Islanders are ironically more democratic than almost any other kingdom in the world because they elect their leader. But someone reminded me that several people reminded me that actually only ship captains are allowed to cast votes.
Okay.
So if you are a captain of one of their longboats, you get to cast a vote.
Still, I think your statement stands more democratic.
It's still more there's like that's more people having a say than who squirted their
bloodline.
Seed in someone's belly and there goes your hair.
Right.
Long live the king. Or queen in this case. And as I mentioned and alluded to in previous podcasts, that the way this is selected is essentially the captains that want to put their hat in the ring. Stand up on the rock, and they give their essentially stump speech, and then they bribe everyone. They literally spill treasure on the ground for people to pick up and scrape, and whoever has the best case and largest loot is seen as a self-evident ruler and is selected by the captains. So, any questions before we move on about some theories around Tommen's secret?
No, I mean, I think that bodes well for my idea that Theon could help her with a vote.
So how does it? Because that would that because
he's
is
a
not
captain,
a boat,
right?
Is he?
Well, wasn't he made a captain
was,
by his father?
I guess, made a captain. He got to command the ship.
That's right.
He was sent off on this mission. Maybe.
I think that counts. I think it counts.
The big question in my mind is how widespread is the knowledge that he's been unmanned? Because I just you know again.
Captain
I just can't see the Iron Islanders getting behind. In fact, I think that would almost be. You know, if he's Yara's running mate, it seems like that would be poison. Because I just don't see the Iron Islanders being like, yeah, we totally respect this guy who's been castrated and tortured and broken and he refused to be, rescued and all that those things. So,
yeah.
I mean, he's also complicit in the death of a lot of Iron Islanders. That now that's probably not common knowledge because they were all slaughtered.
Yeah.
So that probably doesn't bear into proceedings, but I just don't see them. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, because obviously I respect Varys a lot, and he's got the same problem. Mm-hmm. I respect Grey Worm a lot, but I don't see the Iron Islanders doing so.
Okay. I mean, I don't know much about them, but, you know, is he a captain or not? If he's not a captain, then none of this is relevant, I suppose.
Yeah.
If he is a captain, then I don't know why having bait and tackle is
well, the other
relevant.
Thing is, if he is a captain, let's say, because
he's not going
he made
for
a good
himself.
Show of being Theon when he was fooling the Iron Islanders last season into capitulating.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting to see if he, like, you know, if Yara wants him, like, puff out his chest. Because ultimately, in the books, Yara loses her bid, and her uncle Euron, the guy that tossed her father off the bridge, is the one that wins.
Right.
And in the books, it's just essentially Euron comes and promises to take his dragon horn, which I'm curious to see if that pops up, because, you know, if there's no magic dragon horn, then that probably means all that stuff is bullshit.
Right.
But I'm curious to see, because in the book, he blows his dragon horn and says, I'm going to take, all this raping and reaving. I'm going to take over all of Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get these dragons, and I'm going to make Iron Islands great again, essentially.
Yeah, and I assume, you know, he's been pirating for a while. He probably has some booty.
Yeah, he's been pirating all
say,
the world.
Say, vote for me. So, like,
yeah.
Yara and Theon's votes might not even matter at all.
No, I mean, that's the thing. He has, like, twice as much loot. Yeah. And also, he's, you know, inflaming the Iron... Because Islanders have been in decline for a long time. They've been essentially a vassal state and really fallen from their glory. They backed the wrong horse in rebellion and got their asses kicked in by Ned, which is how Theon got to become a hostage in Winterfell in the first place.
Yeah.
So they're kind of smarting from all this and would like to have, you know, the idea of them ruling Westeros. Because in the big Castle of Harrenhal that a lot of Season 2 took place, where Tywin was kind of garrisoned there and Arya was a servant girl, that whole area used to be ruled by the Iron Island. They had significant holdings, but they got thrown off of what the mainland, and then slowly their empire dwindled until they're kind of just having their own islands at this point. Let's see. So that's pretty much that. But what was I saying about the Euron? We're going to be talking about him plenty. But yeah, I'm interested to see if there's the magic horn.
Yeah.
What I was getting at with Theon is, if they don't want to go to magic horn and just, like, I got twice as much treasure, ha ha ha, that works in the books.
Yep.
I wonder if, like, Yara's ace in her sleeve is Theon, you know, being the son of the king and backing her, and he puffs his chest off, and he's trying to be full Theon, and then, like, Euron just comes and gets in his face and, like, crumples him, because he really can't stand up to any kind of, he's going to shrink and,
yeah,
you know, shy away. And that would be, a humiliation that would sell on the show.
Is anybody aware that he's around? It doesn't seem like
it. That's the thing. Yeah. That's why I'm saying, like, waiting in the wings.
Right.
If they want to use the Captain Theon angle.
Uh-huh.
So.
I can see a scene where Theon's doing his thing, and then Euron pulls back his hood and says, oh, yeah?
Yeah, right.
Well, guess who I am.
And yeah, sure. And they can mix and match, like, you know, no treasure but horn, no horn but treasure. Theon, right. I mean, it's like, who knows? But I'm kind of curious, and it seems like we're going to get to that in the next episode or two.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So we talked about Tom in secret, but we didn't actually talk about the secret that he told his mother, because they cut away and we didn't really analyze that very much. And there's a lot of people that had some feedback about this. It seems like there's two popular theories. One, that the secret that he was not supposed to tell his mother was the fact that Marjorie is going to have her walk and the trial's been scheduled, and that's how Cersei knows about that. I think that's what we assumed.
And it might actually even be false information.
Yes. Yes, and I think that's what
we're expecting Tommen to tell her.
That's what I assumed. Yeah. I know we didn't talk about it, maybe because we thought that was the assumption. But the other one that I thought was kind of a bomb, and I don't know what I feel about it, but it's interesting, is that the High Sparrow told Tommen about the Tyrell's conspiracy to kill Joff. Now, the chain of custody there goes. Somehow, Loras knew about that plot, which this is what I want to talk about.
Somehow.
The High Sparrow breaks him.
Mm-hmm.
He tells the High Sparrow, then the High Sparrow feeds this information back to Tommen, which is why he was so visibly upset when he was revealing the secret to his mother. The big question is, did Loras actually know? Because Marjorie didn't until after the fact, and it's not like Queen, the Lady Olenna was like twirling her non-existent mustache and saying, "We off Joff." It was kind of like all like, "Oh yes, dear, don't be too shrinking violet about this."
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how Loras would know unless off screen. And again, I wanted to look this up, but I got this theory yesterday evening. I've been sick, and you'd have to literally watch like 6 hours of television to catch the one or two lines where this might have come to light.
Right.
But if he knows, then that's kind of a hot theory, because mm-hmm. that would piss off Cersei. It would explain, you know, it would set the fact that she's trying to hornswoggle the Tyrells into doing something stupid. It would make a lot. I mean, it makes a lot of sense anyway, but this would add the cherry on top of that conspiracy sundae.
Yeah. Yeah. And it I don't know. It doesn't seem like she needs any more motivation necessarily to throw the Tyrells under the bus.
No, but that would
for maybe a civil war or something. Right. Like, but you're right. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know could contain that anger.
It would
frankly.
It would also explain why Jaime would be gung ho. I mean, I don't think we need to explain that either.
No, I get motivations even without this stuff. But yeah. I mean, it's not a bad angle.
Yeah. My gut says
I don't know how Loras would know.
Right. And that's the thing. And like, if you know for a fact that he did, you know, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com, send it in and we'll talk about it. But my gut says he doesn't know. And why? Now, the other thing is, if Marjorie was indeed broken by the state of her brother, maybe she says it. But that seems like, I mean, there's different degrees of broken, and she didn't seem. Like, maybe she's to the point that she just wants this over with, but why she would implicate her entire family in regicide, which...
Yeah, and I think they'd have to also be playing with the timeline a bit to do that.
Yeah.
Because I think the scenes with Tommen telling Cersei about the secret come before Marjorie and Loras meet. And she sees how broken Loras is.
I don't know about that.
I don't remember
exactly.
It's
one of those things where it's like, it's fresh in my mind, and I watched it again yet today, but like, I couldn't tell you which one came 5 minutes before the other, you know?
Right.
Let's see. Oh, Dan Fermindi, this is a bomb. I'm going to read it on the non-spoiler podcast, too, because it's not a spoiler, but it's fucking awesome, and I want to get it out there quick. Please tell me I'm not the only one who thinks that Littlefinger saying to Robin about his new gift falcon, "Come and see," is no coincidence. Where else do we hear those words over and over again this episode? Maybe the pink letter should actually be called the pinky letter, because I'm pretty sure it came from Littlefinger. That's because that's something that we kind of speculated as a likely theory, and it would be just like the Double D's who did write this episode to drop that for an astute fan. That's a very peculiar phrase, like a biblical, you know, it's a kind of a lyrical thing, and for him to say it earlier in the episode, I think that is pretty clever.
Yeah, I like when they use parallels in language to indicate plot relevance.
Yes.
And I know that has happened before in the series, I think. But yeah, I mean, I'm all on board with the theory that Littlefinger actually sent that letter, even though I don't have a ton to support it.
I had a pretty clean episode last spoiler cast. I didn't get a lot of corrections. I do have some people that had some comments about it, though. Broom Person said, Aaron, I'd like to hear why you think the Dorne plot in the book is so terrible. I agree that the Quentin plot ends up nowhere, but Arianne is interesting in reference to a possible deal or marriage alliance being brokered between her and Aegon in Storm's End. Also, I love the Queenmaker plot and the Darkstar plot. I think it's very fucking cool. We actually get to see Aryo Hotah use that badass axe, and there's all this intrigue involving who Darkstar works for, the Sand Snakes or Doran or someone else. And whether or not Myrcella is really alive anymore, or if they're covering it up, and how Cersei will react when she finds out her daughter has been maimed or killed. Okay. First of all, I love Aryo Hotah. In fact, the last D&D campaign I played with the guys from Personal Arrogance, I essentially lifted that character from the books, changed his name. I even used his fucking backstory about being sold and wedded to his axe and all that stuff to roll like a barbarian human character. So I thought he's great. The whole darks, here's my problem with it. It feels to me like Martin in the second book set up all these crazy details with Dany's prophecies when she went to the House of the Undying. She saw all these crazy visions. And then Martin had all these ideas of how, oh, there's going to be the Mummer's Dragon and this and that. And then when he starts to make good on those, it just spirals. He's a gardener and the shit gets away from him. And it just feels like all of this stuff is an enormous dead end to make the prophecies work so he can fulfill the promise of the second book, you know? And that's my chief frustration is these books deal a lot with the Ironborn, which is the other plot that I don't really give a shit about because there again, it feels a little like that's a kind of going to be a dead end because I just can't see Euron other than getting ships to Dany. And the Victarion plot, I just don't see it going anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's going to be yet another because Dany has to. And by the way, I say this on most podcasts, but if you want to know more about the Dany's prophecies, I did a deep dive on it in one of the past episodes. You can go to the archive that's linked in the show notes and look up Dany's prophecies, and I talk about this. But part of the prophecy is she's got like three mounts to ride, three beds to be carried to, three loves, three betrayals. There's all these things that she has to go through, and people are sifting through and seeing like which one fits what. And I feel like that this Victarion thing is just to check off one of the marriages that she has to go through to get to her whatever end game to make the prophecy fit.
Gotcha.
So it's like that one prophecy feels like it spun off 75% of these plots. And since part of the structure of the prophecy is that these are essentially dead ends and false things, why do I care? I mean, it's sure. A really cool concept, and if this was to be dealt with in like a half a book's time, it would be very cool. The problem is it's exploded into like 2,000 pages of bullshit.
Why we haven't seen a ton of that in the show itself?
I think so. And that's like, I was shocked when we got the Iron Island plot back in this season because I just felt like since we didn't really deal with it and kind of the Theon and Yara stuff got tied up neatly last season that I thought they were just going to streamline that. And I'm like, all right, good. Mm-hmm. So it's more significant than I thought, but most of it, it's just my experience of reading Feast and Dance was Jesus Christ. When can I get back to Brienne, Jaime, or Arya?
Okay,
like you know who this Arianne? I don't give a shit. And again, like on second and third reads, it's become more interesting. And I want to get back to Dany, but Dany just spent so much time doing nothing. So that's kind of why I'm biased against that. There are these new characters and stuff that you know. Oh, revenge for. You know, Prince Oberyn, I was initially invested, but I don't know, man. It just didn't work for me. And I the stuff with the Darkstar, the Queenmaker plot. So what he's referencing is in the book, there's the rebellion against Doran involved kidnapping Myrcella and trying to name her as queen. You know, to take a political coup that way and get popular support in people. And that's foiled by Doran himself. He sends his guardsman, Aryo Hota, who ends up putting that down. And Myrcella takes a sword wound to the face and maybe killed, definitely maimed. Mm-hmm. And, oh, my God, what are we going to do with the Lannisters about that? And then Doran throws them all in prison. And he gives this big speech about, no, I've got this. I've got this long-term revenge. And this is something that me and Oberyn worked out 20 years ago, as soon as this shit happened, and you guys are just fucking impatient and you're fucking up my shit.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, he's dead in the show. So,
right.
Even if you were excited about the Quentin who gets burnt to death and Arianna being perhaps married off to a fake Targaryen, Aegon, and now with the show saying that ultimately this stuff isn't going to matter, I don't know. So that's the, I would say, short version, but it felt pretty long version of why I don't like the Dorn stuff in the books.
Can I throw something out there about the Ironborn plot?
Please do.
You think there's any chance that this is a way to get the Dragonhorn into Dany's hands? Because she doesn't seem to have a great... And also in the show, to get these boats back to her.
Yes. The boats are certainly absolutely crucial.
Right. Super she needs crush. Those. She's got a lot of troops to transport.
Uh-huh.
Is it because she doesn't have a great control over her dragons at the moment?
No, she does
like
not.
Drogon's out flying around doing whatever. Now the other two are. Like, if she had a way to kind of, you know, regroup everybody with this dragon horn.
No, she had like a dog whistle for her dragons. That would be super useful. And yes, I think that. I mean, yeah. So when you put it that way, it seems like the Ironborn are super critical to
That's what I mean. That's why they're coming back.
But on the other hand, it seems like there was a lot of other ways that you could get that to go. Like,
oh, certainly,
Tyrion has all this knowledge of dragons.
But they have a loose end of Theon, right? Like, what's he going to do now?
Yeah.
If not go and do this thing.
Except for that's in the books, Theon's, you know. He's not involved with Sansa. He helped the fake Arya escape the clutches of the Boltons, and he is right now in the camp with Stannis, who is yet to march on Winterfell. So it's like,
okay,
I'm useless for telling you what the hell the books are going to do with Theon.
Well, shit.
Now, there is this kind of theory about, shit, I forget what it's called. It's called like Theon the Latecomer or something.
Mm-hmm.
About that, if there's going to be this disaster, you know, because Euron sends his brother Victarion across the sea with hundreds of ships, or maybe 100 ships.
And we've never even met Victarion, is that right?
So popular theory is, just so you know, that he's going to be rolled into Yara. That Yara is going to be doing everything that Victarion does in the books.
I thought there was a lot of stuff around Theon maybe also doing that.
Well, yes. There is, but I actually kind of, after I've read some of these theories, I kind of like the idea that Yara is going to be. Because in the books, Victarion, as he's sailing away, feels like he was the better king anyway, and the Euron's is like, doesn't have respect for the religion, and doesn't have respect for their traditions, and he starts brooding on it. He has like a near-death experience with a red priest that kind of helps save his life, and he gets this crazy fucking molten arm, and he starts thinking that I should be the one, that why am I going to go and carry this bride? If I carry the bride off, she'll be my bride, and I've got the fucking horn, and it's going to where that Victarion is going to stab Euron in the back, which what the hell happens then? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Cause that's kind of where he hasn't even arrived Dany at the books. So Yara has a lot of the same, you can tell that she's got the same chips on her shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, would kind of be an interesting twist to have Yara make a marriage proposal to Dany. And someone said, and I didn't see this, but someone said in one of the promo trailers that there's a scene of her like kissing one of the whores in Essos on the mouth, like she's like carousing with them
for an upcoming episode.
Yeah, okay. That this is a scene from not an upcoming, like just was sort of the preseason trailer, like one of those smash like half second cuts that they use in between percussion. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that, but if true, that would be kind of a cool gender bend, and it would be, I don't know, I think it would be interesting mm-hmm. to have her make the proposal.
Yeah.
But so where was I going with all this?
Just who might, you know, bring the horn down there, who might be the Victorian stand-in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're right. I mean, the way Martin has chosen to tell the story, it does seem like the Iron Islanders are pretty critical. But I always thought one of the cool theories I thought was maybe they're going to roll like some of those roles into Jorah and Tyrion. Mm-hmm. There's this popular Jorah the Explorer theory that we did last year where it's like, you know, we knew he's going to sail through the Broken Lands and mm-hmm. maybe him and Tyrion come across an artifact and maybe he brings it to Dany and that's how he gets. Well, that never happened, but nope. There's other ways what I was getting at without the Greyjoys and you know, we already had the 100 ships. We just needed fucking Dragonhorn. Could we get the fucking Dragonhorn some other way? But nope, right. Doesn't look like it. TFN 85 said, thoughts on the Born Under a Bleeding Star part of the Prince Who Is Promised prophecy. Talked about this last week and how the Sir Arthur Dayne sword dripping with blood going up the stairs held by Ned could fulfill that prophecy for John. Mm-hmm. He says there are many different theories tossed around on your last podcast of this part and how it could be fulfilled for John. And it got me thinking, could it be as simple as him just being born in Dorne? That is, if R plus L equals J is true, which we all seem to think. We know the Tower of Joy is in Dorne and that the House of Martell rules over the land. House Martell's banner is a red sun pierced with a spear. Could it be that it is the bleeding star? We know suns are just stars, and being pierced with a spear causes bleeding. You guys, okay. I mean,
sure, that doesn't sound wrong.
Does the Westerosi know that the sun is a star? Because that's a fairly modern cosmological view of things.
Right. It's a very non-human centric.
And you could peel it back another level, which is, do the deities that inspire prophecy in Westeros consider the sun a star? Like, I mean, you've already got the sword of the morning, which is dawn, which is covered in blood, which is made from a meteorite. I mean, you've got tons of bleeding stars here that you could work with. So mm-hmm. If that's yet another one you want to consider, I'm cool with it. But I like the idea. Angry Glenn from Chicago chimed in. More info on Germ's Bill Belichick reference that Aaron mentioned in the last podcast. This is a direct quote from A Dance of Dragons, chapter 33, Tyrion, chapter 8. So Bill Belichick, and the quote is, Belicho was a renowned Volantine patriot whose famous exploits are recorded in the series Life of the Triarch Belicho. His unbroken succession of conquests and triumphs ended rather abruptly when he's eaten by giants. And of course, we know giants went against the Patriots twice in the Super Bowl, beat him both times. And this was George Martin essentially beating his chest about it in his own book, which is pretty sick. If you're a sports fan.
I'm not a sports fan, but that's still pretty good.
That's pretty sweet. You got the 1-1, and now you got the Bill Belichick being eaten by giants. So pretty fucking funny. Colin from Brooklyn said, I have a theory for your tinfoil section. It's regards Danny's endgame, and I believe it can be summed up in a single word, Parliament. Now, I'm going to shove you a piece of dry pie in your mouth right there, Colin, because that was a big drum I was beating last season. Yeah. We haven't talked about it this season, but I had this kind of, people ask me, what is the endgame? And, you know, whether it's going to be Danny sitting on a throne or John marrying Danny or what. And I said, if Danny truly wants to break the wheel, the way to do that and to, you know, ensure that you can't have tyrants like her father, the Mad King, ruling over a weak, fleeced populace is to introduce some form of Republican democracy or mm-hmm. parliamentary democracy the way they have in like the United Kingdom. So you'd have like a House of Commons and House of Lords, and they would be and they would rule by the assent of Danny or whoever's on the Iron Throne, but they would actually be answerable to the people.
I assume it would be very primitive form, going back to the Romans.
Sure.
That type of thing.
Yeah. Or like Magna Carta plus maybe. But
right.
What do you think of that idea? Is that too modern of an ending for a fantasy series?
It feels a little too modern for me, but that's not to say it can't happen. I mean, you're right. If she wants to break the wheel, she can't just leave it to the same system that they've had for
Because that's the thing. Ages. She died. Let's say John, right. Danny, or whoever's ruling her, great.
And the next person to come along fucks it all up.
Exactly. The only way to undo that is to have some kind of democracy put into place.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good thought, Colin, and it's something that we talked about a good deal in last season's podcast.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club. But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time. For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Hey everybody, it's time for me to sing for my supper, talk the extolled virtues of club.baldmove.com. So if you go to club.baldmove.com, for as little as a buck a month, you get a whole bunch of bonus features, including ad-free feeds of our podcasts, which, you know, if you get sick of our ads, great way to make them go away. Got bonus content if you just enjoy Jim and I as personalities. We do several bonus features like lunch with Jim and Aaron on Friday afternoons and cocktails with Jim and Aaron on the rocks. He's fucking up our own branding.
Lauded as one of our most enjoyable shows.
On Tuesday evenings where we mix up a new drink and we just talk about stuff. And we have a Q&A app so you can log in and directly interface with us and talk to us about whatever. And we also make those as podcasts too, but they're also a live video feature. Some things of Game of Thrones interest. We're going to be playing through the Telltale last chapter of the Forrester Saga here in the weeks to come. And we also have another special project. Can I actually talk about this?
Yeah. Yeah, we're going out.
We sat down and we played through the Blackwater Epic Battle version of the Battles of Westeros Fantasy Flight board game.
Mm-hmm.
The tabletop.
First battle of that?
Yeah. Jim was Lannisters and I was the Forces of Righteousness, the Baratheons. We'll see if it goes how it does in the books and the show. But that's... And we do a lot of other fun stuff. We've got this quip thing where we pitch fake TV shows to each other. You know, you can watch the live podcast. So, like, if you want to get the instant podcast right away, you can, right after show, you can watch us record it and kind of get plugged in that way. Or if you're at work and you're waiting Tuesday afternoon for the podcast release, we record that thing like 1 o'clock. It doesn't come out till 4. You get it 3 hours early if you want. All at club.baldmove.com. Don't forget about our Gravedigger t-shirt. The Rest in Peace, Mildly Interesting t-shirt. Gravedigger
yes.
t-shirt. Check it out at gravedigger.baldmove.com if you want to look at it. It's designed by me and Jim, but it was executed by our buddy Eric Walquist from Personal Arrogance and Direct Podcast Fame. He's a really good graphic designer. He helped us out on that, and I think it's a cool-looking t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, lots of cool stuff. But yeah, club.baldmove.com is where you want to go if you want extra content and help support us. This cold medication ain't paying for itself. And thank you for all that do support. And also, if you're one of the supporters that are not on the ad-free feeds because whatever reason, you can't figure out how quite to get it to work with your podcaster or whatever, we actually added some technical support documents that walk you through adding the feed to every major podcast app and platform, iTunes and Android and Windows even, I think.
Yeah, it's on your account page.
If you go to your account page, you can actually, if you're one of the ones listening to this because, hey, you know, the ads or whatever, and I just haven't figured it out yet, we got some good information. We're also standing by to help you. So just want to get that out because if you're an ad-free person and you still listen to ads, something has gone wrong.
There's no reason that should happen.
Unless you like our ads. Some people like, you know, I know some of them are more entertaining than others. Yeah. But some people don't mind listening to ads, and God bless you. So that's it. Club.baldmove.com. Thanks for your support. Okay, this is an extremely long theory, but it's super interesting, and it weaves together a lot of details from the books that I haven't seen kind of anywhere into a show format, so you'll have to bear with me, and believe it or not, I actually cut this down by about half. Let's see if my voice holds out. Zach G says, the theory, with the potential deaths of Cersei, Kevin, Tommen, Margaery, Loras, Mace, and Olenna at the hands of the Faith Militant, the High Sparrow will consolidate the power of the Seven with that of the Iron Throne and declare himself king.
Get out of here. They're not going to win this.
Now, here's the deal. I don't know about his final conclusion. We'll talk about that at the end. But I like the mechanics of this theory.
Okay. I don't buy his initial premise that they're going to win this battle.
Okay, so here's how he's going to explain it. He's got a couple of book facts that have not occurred in the series yet, which is, we've alluded to all this stuff before. One, Jaime is sent to the Riverlands with the Lannister army to augment House Frey's troops, which are already laying siege to the house, to the seat of House Tully. So that's the castle where Kat is from. It's also her uncle, the Blackfish. It's where he's at. And in the books, that was still loyal to King Robb. It's still flying the Stark flag, and Jaime's mission is to go there and to break that siege and bring that land under to the king's justice. His second leg is that Euron is made king of the Iron Islands in the upcoming Kingsmoot. So let's talk about both of those. As it presently stands, Margaery and Loras Tyrell, King Tommen's wife and brother-in-law respectively, are imprisoned in the Great Sept of Baelor and awaiting trial by the High Sparrow, while King Tommen's mother, Cersei, is living in the Red Keep on parole. King Tommen has tried at least two times, both unsuccessfully, to assert his authority over the High Sparrow over the last two seasons. On both occasions, Tommen yields to the High Sparrow. King's Landing isn't the place where the meek or wise people live long, especially if they're unwilling or unable to balance wisdom and desire for peace with the ruthlessness required of a ruler. The High Sparrow and the Faith of the Seven are wielding power they haven't wielded for hundreds of years. With Cersei's, Loras, and Margaery's death seemingly more and more of an inevitability, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the Crown's strength is crippled to such a degree that the High Sparrow arrests or executes Tommen and crowns himself king.
I just don't buy that premise. Well, so I don't know why Cersei's in trouble here.
I'll keep reading. In a feast for crows, Cersei sends Jaime and a large force of Lannister soldiers to the Riverlands to aid the Freys in quashing Brendan Blackfish Tully's doomed attempt to hold down Riverrun. If Jaime is at the head of a Lannister army hundreds of miles away in the Riverlands, the Crown will be hard-pressed to protest any potential death sentences handed down for Cersei, Margaery, and Loras. Indeed, in the books, Cersei writes to Jaime an impassioned letter to please come and save my ass from this impending trial by combat, and Jaime crumples it up and throws it in a fire because he's done with her.
Well, that's, yeah, okay, that's different.
But what about Mace Tyrell and the Tyrell army camped outside King's Landing, you say? At the very least, won't they be able to stop the High Sparrow from killing Loras, Margaery, and possibly Tommen? If things play out like they do in the books, Mace Tyrell and all the troops of the with the Reach will be riding to recapture Old Town from the Ironborn and Euron Greyjoy. Because of his next leg, which is Euron will be crowned king of the Iron Islands at an upcoming Kingsmoot in a platform of not just taking back the North or solidifying House Greyjoy's position on the Iron Islands, but of conquering all of Westeros. In the books, Euron bolsters this promise by claiming he will conquer Westeros the same way the Targaryens did with dragons. He brings out one of his crew members, has him blow this enormous jet black horn, yada, yada, yada.
It kills him.
Yep. So his Euron's plan is twofold. Part one is to send his Iron Fleet to Meereen to rescue or carry off Dany and her three dragons and claim Dany as his wife and queen. With the Dragonbinder Horn, even the dragon's connection to Dany as their mother won't be able to break his control of the dragons. Part two, he begins destabilization of Westeros' biggest, richest, and most plentiful kingdom, the Reach, and its biggest city, Old Town. Which is where the Citadel is, which is also where Sam's going, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. In the books, Euron and the Ironborn capture the Shield Islands, which are the bulwark against the invasion of the Reach by sea, and send several successful raiding parties up the Mander River, one of the largest in the Reach. Later, we find out the Ironborn have engaged in several skirmishes with the Old Town City Watch. These attacks have been repulsed so far, but an invasion of Old Town and the rest of Reach after that seems imminent. Side prediction time. Euron and Ironborn will attack and capture Old Town later this season. This, in turn, will cause the Reach to send a force of troops to retake Old Town. In the books, the majority, though not all, of the Reach's troops are outside King's Landing under the command of Mace Tyrell and Randall Tarly, which I think is true in the show, too, because that's what Kevin alluded to, is he'd have to stand down to let them into the city.
Right.
And if their images of Jaime and Mace at the head of a large army shown in the trailer bear out, this will be the way it goes in the show as well. With a majority of the Crown's troops invested in River Run and attempting to retake Old Town, it leaves the capital city with a diminished force, meaning its defenses will be weakened. This is where the High Sparrow comes in. All of this is building to a situation where Cersei's trial... will occur after the Lannister and Tyrell troops have left King's Landing, leaving Cersei, Tommen, and the rest of Lannisters and Tyrells with a diminished garrison. Now, you may be thinking, even the diminished force of the Lannister and Tyrell soldiers outfitted in full plate and mail should be able to hold off the unarmored Sparrows. However, in the books, these aren't the only armed regiment of the Faith Militant. There is a knight by the name of Sir Bonifer the Hasty, who leads a detachment of 87 armored knights, known for poetic reasons as the Holy Hundred, which haven't been introduced or even mentioned in the show, but would be easy for the Double D's to introduce through a couple of episodes before Cersei's trial and for the High Sparrow to call upon them to reinforce the warrior's sons holding King's Landing. Assuming Cersei loses her trial and is sentenced to death, it wouldn't be surprising for Tommen to attempt to stop the Faith from carrying out Cersei's death sentence. If Tommen does try to intervene personally, for purposes of this theory, I'm going to assume he does, he will most likely be arrested and condemned to death himself. In either case, the Iron Throne would be vacant, and anyone would be hard-pressed to stop the High Sparrow and the Faith Militant. I think if the High Sparrow will consolidate the power of the Seven with the power of the Iron Throne and declare himself the new king of the Seven Kingdoms...
Hypocrite.
In conclusion, GRRM Gurm is quoted as saying the Iron Throne will change hands at least one more time in the books before the end, with the best candidates in the book being Fake Aegon or Aegon. I'm probably tipping the scales by calling him Fake Aegon. And or Euron. And it makes sense that this will be true in the show as well. Even though the Double D's have put a 15-episode cap on the remaining Game of Thrones series, it stands to reason Tommen won't be on the Iron Throne with Dany, Jon, or the White Walkers reach King's Landing. All right. Before I talk about my own spin, because I don't agree with this conclusion that the High Septon is just going to put the crown on his head. But do you see how this theory tracks pretty clean?
Yeah. So there's a reason why. So at the beginning of this, I was absolutely unconvinced. Like, there's nothing to say.
So was I.
That Cersei or Tommen would be killed.
Yeah.
Because it's not happened yet in the show, right? Like, so much of this stuff in the books has happened in a different order. Like, if Jaime's out and, like, you can see kind of the writing on the wall where may not be enough troops and you can see other forces in movement here, I think it makes a lot more sense now that he's explained what's happened in the books.
Yeah.
We just haven't seen...
Exactly.
Like, those breadcrumbs haven't been dropped yet
exactly.
in the show. So, yeah, I mean... If they're going to go that way, and there's, you know, no guarantee they will or won't,
yeah,
then yeah, that seems plausible. It actually feels fairly satisfying that toward the end of this thing we'd get some kind of major clash of forces here, and that would be kind of the downfall, is that they just spread themselves a little too thin,
and that's
they maybe make the wrong call sending forces somewhere.
They're planning on something, and a third party comes in and fucks
absolutely,
them, which
it's just like Silicon Valley this week.
I haven't got that far.
Pretty much.
I'm one down, but yeah, no, I think it's great because it uses a bunch of details in the books that haven't been introduced, but it's all plausible, and it sounds like something the show might do.
Yeah,
and also fits with stuff we know in the trailers. As far as why Jaime would have been, because the other thing is, like, you know, if the largest city in the Reach gets attacked, you know why the Tyrells would spin their forces down. Mm-hmm. But why would Jaime be willing to do this, or Kevin, when, you know, the Queen Mother's on the line? Matt from Chicago has an idea of why Jaime and Cersei might be on the outs. He says, in the books, during the escape from King's Landing, Tyrion tells Jaime about Cersei's many infidelities. This revelation plays over and over again in Jaime's mind, driving him further away from Cersei. Because in the book, Jaime loves Cersei, and she's the only woman he's ever loved.
Mm-hmm.
This never happens in the show, in which it conversely appears that Jaime and Cersei's relationship is becoming even stronger since Jaime's return to King's Landing. This discrepancy has been mentioned several times in the podcast. What if the wedge between Jaime and Cersei is necessary for the overall plot? And if so, I think the Double Ds may use Cersei's trial as a vehicle through which Jaime comes to learn about Cersei's additional transgressions. So these facts, this new shit comes to light during Cersei's trial. It disgusts Jaime, and then he's like, well, fuck it, I'm riding out. I don't give a shit about this anymore.
Maybe, but where's he riding out to?
It'd have to be to save old Dan's ass, or...
Or to combat Dorne in the field, maybe a little further south.
Yeah, it's true, because you could be a it could be a Marcella thing. It could be that the Tyrells got, hey, we got problems back in Reach. The Lannisters have to go deal with the Dornishmen, which leaves King's Landing ripe for the High Sparrow's taking. Now, I don't like the idea of the High Sparrow sitting on the throne. I think it's...
He would be a crazy hypocrite.
Well, it's a crazy breach of everything.
Right.
What there is precedent is like a puppet king in the form of King Baelor, where you have the zeal of a convert, and you sit this like... Because in this stage of Game of Thrones, you've got a situation where the High Sparrow has traditionally been a puppet of the king.
What, could they put Lancel on the throne?
That was my first thought. Okay. But I don't see how, you know... The idea that the Faith of the Seven has to uphold the king, and part of that is the tradition of genealogy and heraldry and all that stuff. I had a crazy thought of, like, what if it's Gendry?
Okay. Well, he'd have to show back up at some point, yeah.
But, I mean, he's been somewhere, and I think that if I don't know how the High Sparrow would know that he was the son of King Robert. But it would be interesting because this guy's a common born. He's a bastard. He's just the type of candidate the High Sparrow would like to put up there and prop up and be a yes man. It could be it could actually be Tommen. Now,
maybe
how he kills Cersei and Margaery and
alienate Tommen.
Tommen would have to be really fucking brainwashed, which he's a young kid and the High Sparrow is doing a pretty good job of mind fucking him anyway. Any other candidates?
What if he pardons that, Margaery in exchange for a little puppetry?
And over what Tommen.
Look, we got to kill your mom. We got to kill Lena.
What if Cersei confesses to all this in court or is accused, and Tommen's kind of disgusted with his mother, and the High Sparrow's like, look, your mother has done too much bad shit, but you know, Margaery's a good girl and she's wanting to change, and we'll let you have Margaery, but right. Like, I could see that.
She could be the pawn that the High Sparrow needs to get control over Tommen, honestly.
Yeah.
But then I think it'd be a war of Margaery versus the High Sparrow, because Margaery's no slouch.
Well, sure.
In that area.
And that might be where the High Sparrow has bit off more than he can chew.
The High Sparrow might have the king's ear, but she's got other parts of it.
Yes, wrapped around her.
That we've seen her use.
Various appendages.
Yeah.
And the other thing is he's also laid the seeds for, like, you know, that the marriage is a holy thing and it's sacred and people shouldn't get in between that. So there's a lot. Like I said, I don't know about his in-game prediction, but I really like the mechanics of this. And it really smooths a lot of things out from what the hell's going on in the books versus the show in a pretty satisfying way. All right. I know that was long, but I thought it was pretty cool. Doug L. is taking the idea of time-traveling Bran to a very extreme level.
Oh, boy.
Says, essentially, this idea is a causality loop. Brandon Stark is alleged to be the first Stark who raised the wall in Winterfell many thousands of years ago, the Bran the Builder from the legends of old.
Mm-hmm.
But what if Bran Stark becomes powerful enough to travel back and become Brandon Stark and thus become his own ancestor?
Mm-hmm.
With the show seemingly confirming, when I'll back up a bit and say suggesting, his ability to at least influence the past, it's an interesting tinfoil idea. And he linked me to an article from the A Song of Ice and Fire website, the kind of unofficial wiki. And this is a theory from the forums back from 2014. And I gotta say that the whole theory is based on the idea that Bran as a boy knew Winterfell like the back of his hand.
Okay.
Someone mentions that he knew every stone, that Bran in his head imagines that he's the true Lord of Winterfell because he has this unusual connection to it, and he mentions it in a way, he's connected in a way that even his father and Rob, who are the Lord and heir, couldn't imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's this quote from A Game of Thrones chapter 24, Bran part 4, where it says thousands and thousands of years ago, Bran the Builder had raised Winterfell, and some said the Wall. Bran knew the story, but it had never been his favorite. Maybe one of the other Brandons had liked the story. Sometimes Nan would talk to him as though he were her Brandon, the baby she'd nursed all those years ago. And sometimes she's confused him with his uncle Brandon, who was killed by the Mad King before Bran was even born. She had lived so long, Mother had told him once, that all the Brandon Starks had become one person in her head. Suggesting that perhaps Bran is all Brands of all times. And that's essentially, like, there's a lot of other kind of meta reasons why the guy likes the theory, and there's a lot of the stuff where we've already talked about, you know, all the parts in the book where Bran tries to communicate with someone and fails. I don't know. I mean, this is the logical conclusion, or maybe the what do you call that argument by absurdity? This is the absurd. This is the absurd end to the Bran, the originator theory.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But I wanted to get it out there just in case anyone else found it interesting. I will link the full theory in the show notes, the thread to it. But I found the foundations pretty flimsy.
And I mean, Bran, you know, if you're a time traveling do-gooder, maybe do some more good. Like, does all this death and suffering, this war for the Iron Throne, really need to happen in the first place? Can you make things?
Well, that's the whole idea of the causality loop. Is like, you can't change the things you can't change. It's like, you know, we just watched Donnie Darko, and I imagine it's a similar kind of state where it's like.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what way they go with time travel.
If they go with time travel,
if they're even going with time travel, but sure.
But certainly interesting, and one of those things where it's got a surprising amount of textual support, but it's fairly anecdotal and non-empirical support. Julie G says, you guys were discussing the implications of Bran being able to possibly speak to people through the trees or the wind, like Jon and the direwolves. The phrase that popped in my head was words are wind. It's something that George Martin uses again and again and again. That's like a watchword in his books. What if Martin hid that clue in what seemed like yet another one of his overused cliches? Saucy. I mean, yeah, that's one of those things where it's like words are wind. Could be just a experience. That's essentially saying talk is cheap. It's
right.
The Westerosi version of saying that. But if literally the words are wind coming from Bran, coming from the trees, I don't know.
And if that's the only way in which he can influence the past through verbal communication on the wind, maybe there's reasons why he doesn't do more, like I was talking about. But
yeah, that's the thing. Like, I've never understood whether that's just to indicate that he's such a powerful green seer, that he's so powerful he can actually be heard through time, or whether that's something that any sufficiently powerful green seer, including the three-eyed raven, could do, but there's like a rule against it. Like, you're not supposed to go and meet your past self or whatever, because the universe could explode or whatever Doc Martin said.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. And again, I'm not terribly excited about the potential of time travel, but I'm certainly not against it, because, like, yeah, it's kind of, as I said, my jam. I like a good time travel paradox story.
Yeah.
Not sure about mixing it up in my epic fantasy, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. Let's see. Buddy C said, one thing I wanted to, haven't heard anyone mention, but I want to throw out there. Arya could potentially get two names crossed off her list because of her non-actions. Arya's list no longer had the Hound on it, as she realizes she didn't want him to die. She left him to die, but she didn't kill himself. This leads probably to his spiritual renewal and eventually fight with his brother in the Climb Ball! Anyway, in doing this, if the Hound defeats his brother, then Arya's mercy will have actually crossed two names off her list, Cersei and the Mountain. By not killing the Hound, she sets in motion a string of events that eventually gets a two-for-one off her list. What do you think of that concept?
How is Cersei going to get killed?
So you spare... It's the logical outcome of the Mountain losing his trial.
Oh, okay.
So Mountain
gotcha.
Fights for Cersei. The Hound fights
but
for the Fae.
But then how is the Hound going to die?
The Hound's not. The Hound kills
okay.
the Mountain.
He's just a lovable guy all of a sudden.
Although,
and so Arya doesn't want
although
him.
It could happen if you want to make it mirror just like Oberyn. Maybe the Hound
right.
is mortally wounded in the fight. They both die, but the Hound is the victor. Cersei's condemned to death. Bam, you got a clean sweep.
Yeah.
So Arya's mercy actually serves the god of death better than just her going after him.
Could be.
That was an interesting theory. Connor OB wanted to share a crazy meta realization about the Tower of Joy that he found on Reddit, which was by Controve T. Says, all right, in the latest episode, Bran visited the Tower of Joy. In the start of the series, Jon Snow is 17 years old in show canon, so Robert's Rebellion and the fight at the Tower of Joy happened 17 years ago. Gurm said the time that has passed from a Game of Thrones to a Dance of Dragons is around 3 years. We can assume this is for the show at the end of season 5 as well. This means that when Bran sees the flashback of the Tower of Joy, he sees something that's happened nearly 20 years ago. The crazy thing is, in A Game of Thrones was published in 1996, also 20 years ago. This book had the Tower of Joy scene portrayed in Oathbreaker, which is even more crazy for those who actually read it 20 years ago when it came out. In this episode, Bran sees something that happened 20 years ago, and we as viewers did as well. Does that blow your mind?
Okay, sure.
I mean, it's an accident, like... You know what I'm saying? Like, it's an accidental thing, but it's a nice round number, and, you know, it's kind of cool that it lines up at the show's timeline.
Assuming R plus L equals J, but yeah.
I think that's
an assumption I'm willing to make.
Like, I was 99% sure, now I'm 99.9%.
It's
approaching a probability of 1.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what 2-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Matt from Chicago says, in the books, during his escape from King's Landing, Tyrion tells Jaime... Oh, wait. I served you a piece of dry pie. Caused a causality loop because I already read that email. Daniel B. says, I've got a quick question for you regarding the impact of the Book of Stranger on the R plus L equals J theory. It seems to be implied that Targaryens are fireproof, with Dany surviving significant fires on 2 separate occasions with not a scratch on her. But flashback to season 1, when Jon's hand was burned when saving the Lord Commander from the reanimated body brought back to Castle Black, does this mean that he isn't a Targaryen?
No, so I don't know that it's fair to assume that all Targaryens are fireproof.
Yes.
Dany is, 100%.
Yes, in the show.
Right, so... I don't know that that excludes Jon as a Targaryen just because his hand got burned.
Because her brother Viserion, which we know is a full-blooded Targaryen, died from molten gold.
Yeah.
Aegon V died at the fire in Summerhall. Arryon Brightflame tried to rekindle dragons by drinking wildfire, and he burned to death.
Sure, okay.
So there's lots of Targaryens that gone up in smoke.
I think it's just Dany.
I think it's just Dany. Now, I don't know why... It's just, that's the thing. Yeah. Why is this happening? Like, I bought it at first because, well, it's blood magic, whatever. You know, why did the dragons hatch? Who the fuck knows?
Mm-hmm.
Now that it's like a power that she just has, which also is annoying because now it's like, it seems like the strategy is just, and it'd be badass, is have her walk right up to King's Landing in a carpet of dragon fire, go right up to the Iron Throne and sit on it while, you know, the dragons can just be breathing fire on 24/7. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Like, I don't...
It's the ultimate weapon.
It seems like OP.
She doesn't even need the Unsullied. She doesn't need the Dothraki. She needs a single dragon.
No.
Lay down a carpet bomb.
Yeah. Like she
and just walk through it.
Yeah, that seems like an unbeatable strategy. We will see. Reed B. from Calgary says, I have a tinfoily idea for the week. We know that Euron has a magical horn that burns your lungs and maybe or likely gives some power over dragons and is rumored to be able to awaken stone dragons.
Oh, you can't burn Dany's lungs. She's going to blow that horn, no problem.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Fucking fireproof Dany strikes again.
Yep.
Lungs of asbestos this woman's got. We also know that the wildlings were searching for a big horn that would apparently bring down the wall. Mm-hmm. We also know that there are rumors of an ice dragon or dragons frozen in the wall. I don't know if you knew that.
I don't.
All right, just but roll with it.
Sounds cool.
What if the horn that the wildlings were looking for is the ice equivalent to Euron's fire horn? And what if the ice horn summons or wakens the ice dragons frozen into the wall, thus breaking a lot of, at least part of the wall, but unleashing this new weapon? It could even be in a case of others break glass sort of situation. The people living north of the wall get this horn. If the others are ever starting causing shit again, you blow it and deploy your nukes.
All right.
I know there's also speculation there are dragons or ice dragons in the bowels of Winterfell. The same idea then. You blow the ice horn, awaken the dragon, nuke the enemy. I know this is basically a fanfic idea. Oh, my first clue was the multiple what ifs. But I got to thinking about it while checking out Gurm's website, because he has a children's book called The Ice Dragon, which I have not read, but is set in the world of ice for Song of Ice and Fire, which makes me think that there really are ice dragons in this world. Now, if you go through the archive, which, again, this is linked in every single spoiler podcast, there is one that I did in Season 4, which I believe is the one that is 404, The Wall, The Night's King, and Rethinking the Others. But I think there's also elements in the Tyrion Lannister Secret Targaryen one as well, that talk about the possibilities of ice dragons and whatnot. But no, here's the thing. I don't know how crazy this show can get. Like, if there's ice dragons and stone dragons and dragons and sea dragons, like, at what point will people be like, I thought I was watching a taut political thriller with a little bit of magic here and there, and now I've got full-blown Dungeons & Dragons.
Right. Like, I mean, that's kind of what I signed up for in the beginning, is the political intrigue.
And I mean, they could bring you along.
Right.
But it's just as likely that they're going to turn off the core audience that they built. It's like, you know, I don't usually like this sort of swords and sandals, dragons thing, but this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
An adult. And throw in a bunch of blue dragons and red dragons and black dragons and gold dragons and green dragons and
sea dragons. Like,
you know, it's like, are you selling toys? Are there going to be a line? Like, what's the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
So I that's the only concern I have, because this all sounds cool, but, like, you know, and there's even literary and biblical stuff about going up to a wall and blowing a horn and a wall falling down. But, like, if all of this stuff happens, it feels like the world's now full to bursting with almost silliness.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how people, like, or even me, like, that's not the Game of Thrones I signed up for either.
Are the ice dragons ice dragons in name only, or do they, like, shoot ice from their mouths instead of fire?
No one knows.
Okay.
There is no information at all about what an ice dragon would
be. Sea dragons? Are they
different?
Are they like the Loch Ness Monster, or are they just...
I've told you everything I know about a sea dragon, which is supposedly there's a carcass of one on Old Wick.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, that's... Nobody really knows, so...
We just know about dragons.
Dragons. The dragons that Danny's got.
Yeah.
So... And the historical dragons, of course, too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, there's no other type of dragon in living memory that would meet these. So, but I did. That's one of the things I mentioned, is the fact that it's crazy. But then he did write a book called The Ice Dragon, which, again, it's a children's book. But so was The Hobbit, and look what happened there. Tan from, or maybe it's Tane, from Land's Own, Ontario, or maybe it's Land's On, Ontario. I'm bombing here. It's the cold medication, folks. Just wondering if you remember the last time we saw Bran's wolf, Summer. I can't tell you the last time we saw him.
I just read an article recently about where the wolves are.
Okay.
And Summer is apparently up there with him.
Yeah.
Like, just chilling. But I haven't seen Summer on screen in a long time.
In the books, he's definitely with Bran in the cave.
Okay.
And, I want to say that there's evidence that Ghost somehow has lost his connection, you know, because all these Stark wolves have some kind of telepathic communication with each other. Like, they know when one of them dies. And there's some evidence that Ghost has lost that link with Summer when he goes into the cave, which is another evidence that this is somehow specially magically warded. But I know he's there, and I know he hasn't died in the series, so I'm assuming he's just there, but they just historically don't show the CGI wolves as much as you would think, because it costs money to CGI him up. She also wonders, could Azor Ahai's flaming sword be Valyrian steel? I'm specifically thinking of Longclaw, if Jon is indeed the prince that was promised. It seems likely that Lightbringer, which is the infamous sword of the prince who was promised, which Lady Melisandre helped Stannis do a pale imitation of by using trickery to set his blade on fire. It seems likely that that would be Valyrian steel, because we've seen what a bang-up job it does against the others and the Whites, right?
Yeah.
Now, there are some theories that I'm familiar with about Longclaw being the actual sword, because legend has it that this thing, I'm going to talk about the full legend here in a minute, but legend has it that this sword is pulled from the flames, and the way, if you consider how Jon acquired the sword, he set the Lord Commander's apartment on fire, essentially, to kill the White that had tried to kill, to take his life, and immediately afterwards, the Lord Commander granted him Longclaw. So you could, in an Obi-Wan Kenobi certain point of view sense, say that Jon pulled this blade from the fires. But I don't like any of those theories, because I don't think Lightbringer is an actual blade that's still in existence. I think it's a metaphor for what it takes to kill, to eliminate the threat of the others. Because the legend has that Azor Ahai forged the Lightbringer. First, he worked 30 days and 30 nights on this fucking sword, and he quenched it in water, and it shattered. He then went back to work and made it even a finer blade, and he spent 60 days and nights. And this time, he quenched it in the heart of a living lion, just plunged it right into fucker. Went to go temper it, and it smashed into a million pieces again.
What gave him that idea? Like, you know what? It didn't work last time when I tried this. Let's go with the heart of the living lion. I think that might
work. Saberhagen went there, too. Like, all of his blades of men, fantastic swords of power were quenched in the hearts of men. Like, that's some kind of special, like...
Okay.
You know, it's like blood magic. Like, you're sacrificing a soul to do it. And here's the kicker. He went right back to work 100 days and 100 nights while the others are just chilling.
That'll do it.
Plunged the blade into the heart of his wife, Nissa Nissa.
All right, cool.
And then it burst into flames and became Lightbringer. And so if that's a literal story, fine. But if it's a metaphor, it's something that it's a work of love and sacrifice that is enable you to wield a weapon that can destroy the others. There's also,
I think that's a pretty shitty thing to do to your wife.
Well, she bared the breast. She's like, come on.
All right.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It wasn't,
it was her sacrifice, not his.
Well, I think you'd argue it was both if he loved his wife. But yeah, it's something that they knew needed to happen. Like, they knew, like it said, like when he tried his lion experiment, he knew he's on the right track, but he actually knew that what was going to be really required. And he told,
well, it was non-consensual. The heart stabbing. You needed a consensual heart stabbing.
You have to have
a
being, a courageous being that's willing to be sacrificed.
Huh.
But no, so I always thought that was a metaphor for the kind of love and sacrifice that you're going at, which I think means bad things for a lot of the heroes of the story. Like, I don't see John and Danny, even if Danny makes it through as a hero, because there's lots of signs that she could go Mad King. There's also a lot of signs that maybe John goes Winter King or the Night's King. So even all that said, there's going to be some great sacrifice involved to defeat the others. I don't know what that is, but I don't like the idea of, like, you can just find Lightbringer and that's the key and everything's hunky-dory.
Okay.
So that's my thoughts. I could be wrong. Maz sent a lengthy email explaining their excitement of being an OG book fan, and this person at least has been a fan since A Storm of Swords. So he remembered waiting for a feast to come out, and then remembered waiting for a dance to come out, and, you know, his kind of mixture of excitement, but then disappointment of how that stuff is going, and how frustrated that the plot's kind of stalled out. Now I'm going to just start reading from the email. I think the show overtaking the books is leading up to a very unique time. For the instant take, I suspect that you, Aaron, had a similar emotional excitement from that scene that you found difficult to fully express, and maybe you've had a chance to since then, but Jim didn't seem to be so affected. Well, I think, well, yeah, there's a lot of different... cybernetic nature of the organism is one part. I think maybe the scene wasn't as emotional for show-only watchers as it was for us because we have read the books. Furthermore, maybe now that the show has overtaken the books, we're going to be the ones screaming and wailing at the television as a reverse of past seasons. What do you think? I know in the podcast you talk about all the book readers that whine about each episode, but I think they're a very small part of any community. I bet for each one of them, there are 10 who are satisfied but don't say anything. Well, here I am, a book reader nerd that, as of this episode, believes the Double D's are adding a quality to the story that Martin couldn't have done alone. I think the two are better than either, and I think the show finishing the story is best.
All right.
That's a controversial opinion. I do think after reading Feast and Dance that Martin could use an Iron Throne sitting editor. Someone that's be like, look, man, look, you have, this is like the 13th chapter in a row where people have essentially walked somewhere and then some big fucking thing happens at the end. And then the next time we visit them, you flash forward past that exciting thing. Like, you can only do that so many times before you got it. You can't have Sansa wandering through the mountains for 20 pages talking about lemon cakes in her fucking head. You just can't do it. But whereas the Double D's are like, okay, we've got the reins. We are going to hammer this out.
They are the editor.
They are the editor that he might have needed and can really weed. Because that's the thing. Like, Martin's a gardener. I think that he's used too much fertilizer and bullshit, and the garden's gotten away from him.
He's got dandelions,
and that's the hard part. Like, generating the plot, and the complexity is the hard part. Arguably, editing it down and consolidating and adapting it, not trivial, but much easier than coming up with the idea in the first place. So,
for sure.
I actually think the Double D's might be able to fly here. Whether it's best. I think what's best is for Martin to tell the books and then let them adapt them from the whole series. But, you know, adapting from the cliff notes and the bullet points, I think the season's been great. I think the season's much better paced than last season.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it a lot so far.
And I wasn't the ones that hated last season, but I remember thinking, like, man, I'm kind of scared that this is the season the Game of Thrones is going to jump the shark because I don't know how they're going to adapt this. And, you know, there's still a lot of pacing and plot issues. And I've been, on the whole, really pleased with how it's gone.
Yeah, and I think it's easier for me as a show watcher to not give a shit about how it's breaking the books or how George is going to come back around and write a book that's satisfying with the show out there. Like, none of that matters to me because I'm not going to read the books and I'm
a show owner. But I was worried that, like, if we got through season 6 and Danny was still in Marine, like, even the show, you don't have any expectations, but it's like, come the fuck on.
Right.
So, like, she got burnt up in season 1 with her dragons, and, like, what the hell? She got the Unsullied in season 3. What the, you know?
Yeah. The addition of Tyrion helped that.
Yeah.
And Varys.
And again, I feel like I will be shocked if she's not boarding boats and leaving or with plans to do so forthwith at the end of the season.
Okay.
But we'll see. Jackson from Oklahoma says, hey guys, with the Double D saying they have only about 13 episodes remaining to be told and with HBO foaming at the mouth for more seasons, what do you think the likelihood of a prequel, sequel, or lateral quequel?
What?
Lateral quill. I don't know how you pronounce that, even if I didn't have a shit ton of Dayquil in me. Series coming down the pipeline. I know the speculation is way early, but with them following A&E with the day late post show, I can see them copying spinoffs. I think he means AMC.
Game of Thrones, The Next Generation.
He says the possible titles, Fear the Walking Whites, Better Call Bran the Builder,
okay.
Tales of Dunkin' Egg, which I'd love to see the producers of Rick and Morty do. That would be fucking crazy, Dan Harmon unleashed. Because he's a big Game of Thrones fan, and he does his Harmontown podcast. This is the producer of Community and of Rick and Morty, which if you haven't seen it, Jesus Christ, go watch it. It's hilarious. Mm-hmm. He's been at the end of his podcast, he always devolves into some kind of improvisational comedy. And he had Grey Worm on 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they did this fucking hilarious improv about the Game of Thrones universe. And he's not one that sweats the details or the names, but that'd be kind of crazy. He continues, I know this is all just hopes and pipe dreams of fans that don't want their ride to stop, but with the wealth of material Gurm has provided instead of the last two goddamn books, there's plenty of source material available. Does HBO have the rights to it? Would you guys be interested in it, or does it run the risk of ruining something we all know and love? Is the risk too high? What do you think, Jim?
Duncan Egg 9. All my sequels are from Star Trek.
I like the Duncan Egg series.
Do you? I don't know anything about it.
But I don't know that it would provide more than a season or two. And it's also a prequel, which is ultimately less interesting.
I mean, you're describing Better Call Saul, which is a prequel and we didn't think had legs. So
that is true. But there again, like
but it's already written. I mean, the Duncan Egg stuff is there.
And you'd have to argue that this stuff is interesting in its own right, or would with the Star Wars prequels, it was ultimately interesting because you want to know about Darth Vader. Who is the person?
The Mad King. I don't know.
Who's the person 100 years ago that's influenced, like, if the three-eyed raven was actually this Brendan Rivers blood raven character, and that he kind of comes in at the tail end of the third of the Hedge Knight series, maybe that's interesting, but like that's kind of an unfinished tale into its own right.
Yeah. I mean, I would really love to see some more stuff with Ned and Rob, like how that whole rebellion happened.
You could do the Robert's Rebellion series.
Right.
You could do a lot of... So the thing is I don't...
Maybe an anthology series of like different times from Game of Thrones?
I do absolutely know, because some people have pitched this as a way to give Martin a chance to catch up, that they might shut down production and then do these and then get back to... That's never, ever going to happen.
No.
There's no way they can hold on everyone's contracts. These kids are not stopping growing up.
Right.
You're going to be completely ridiculous if you don't end this and end it within a reasonable time frame. Mm-hmm. So as far as will HBO want to continue to milk in the cash cow, I think sure. I think if they can – I know that the Double D's, I think, have said in an interview this last season that they are not interested in doing it.
I've heard that they are kind of over Game of Thrones.
Yeah, like not that it's kind of
like they just want to get it over with and be done.
Like. Sure, and I don't think that's in a negative way. It's just like this has been a huge labor of theirs over, and it's just ruled their life. They don't do anything but make Game of Thrones.
They want to do other things, is what they said.
So, but on the other hand, HBO has crazy stable of talent and can recruit more, and a hot property like this.
Right.
Would be something a lot of people would like to direct and write for. So, I mean, yeah, I could see them doing it, but, like, you know, you're not going to hear any of that until, like, the last season, if there's any kind of contracts or stuff in the works. But it won't involve any of the original cast, probably won't involve a lot of the crew, and it's going to be one of those things where, you know, be careful what you wish for, because I, for one, thought Peter Jackson's adaptation of The Hobbit was hot shit.
It was terrible.
It's just you can go to the okay, well, you want to tell Duncan Egg, and then you want to go start plumbing the world of Ice and Fire and start bringing the appendixes in, and suddenly you've got a nice tight novella that's 1,000 pages long, and you got to adapt that thing. And I just don't know. Like, if you ask me, do I want to see more Game of Thrones type stuff? Sure. But I
feel like
this,
they're telling the most interesting stories from that world right now.
That's the thing. Duncan Egg is not nearly as interesting. It's a single point of view of a relatively simple person and a relatively simple plot that's told in a straightforward manner.
Yeah.
And it was interesting and entertaining, and I liked it, and I love my illustrated copy, but it's not nearly as complex and adult and mature as, you know, a Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So...
maybe they do an animated series.
Yeah. I mean, HBO's done that before. They did the Spawn thing.
Spawn?
Yeah, you remember that?
I believe they
did a bunch of Hellboy animation stuff.
Was that them? Okay.
So they've done some fairly mature animated things that would certainly cost a whole hell of a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
A whole hell of a lot less. Okay, so let's continue on. I think we got two more to go. Matthew M. I'm a show watcher only, joining in on the spoiler section this year, so please forgive my ignorance, but when the faceless men take the face of another, do they also take the body as well? If it works that way, how would you guys feel if Arya takes the face and or body of the Hound and kills the Mountain in a show remix of the version of the Gravedigger Clegane? I can't do it in my throat. It was unwise of me to do it twice with a sore throat. This would check and name off her list and tie nicely into the idea of faceless men wanting to balance the mountain, being brought back to life, and cheating the god of death. Seeing Melisandre without her glam on in episode 1 could be part of the reveal that this magic of taking or appearing in different body is possible and available. Arya's new skills in the Hound's body would be badass.
You're too new. You're too new to the spoiler podcast because we all know that the Hound is not dead. His face has not been reaped.
That's true.
Or we're all working and on also, that assumption.
I tried to do some research today, and people are all... My opinion was, no fucking way. They can't change their size and shape. It's like Odo and Deep Space Nine.
I thought they just
Nine.
Came with the face.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's like Odo and Deep Space Nine. He can turn into a chair. He can turn into a humanoid of about his size and shape. He cannot appear as a house cat. And he can't appear as a giant dragon. Like, there's only so much he can do with his size and shape.
I thought he could.
No, I thought, in fact, you just watched the series, but I thought that was a whole point, that, like, he can only attain the shape that's... Can you think of him, like, turning into something handheld? Why am I...
Well, he fits in a bucket when he's...
That's true.
Like, a human being, no matter how you try, no matter how you squeeze and squish, is not going to fit in a bucket. No way. Not a little pail.
A
5-gallon
bucket, I can fit you in there.
Maybe.
Give me a blender.
But not Odo's little sleeping pail. He's
okay. No. You might have me, and this has no bearing. This was an analogy, and it's entirely right. Inaccurate. So strike it from the record. But It was always my impression that like Arya could appear to be roughly a size and shape of a person that she is with a face. And when she's undergoing her training, there's an interesting back and forth where she's begging the kindly man to teach her the magic of turning, changing into her face, changing her face. And he's like, well, that takes years and years of practice and magic to master. And she's disappointed. And he's like, but if you want to, he goes, but I can tell you the first step. And he says, puff out your cheeks and stick out your tongue. And she does so. And he goes, there you've changed your face.
Yep.
But his larger point is at the end of it, he says, why use magic when a mummer's trick would suffice?
Right.
Which suggests that you can hunch down, you can wear platform shoes, you can do a lot and enhance that with the glamour.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know the idea of just taking over, like becoming the mountain if you're Arya. Now,
right. It's like the Pink Panther. You just disguise yourself up a little bit.
And you put magic on top of that, and who knows what happens. Now, having said that, there's a lot of people that say just the opposite, that if you got magic, you can do anything you want.
That's true.
There is nothing in the canon that suggests, like, Melisandre has glamored a man to look like another man. She's glamored herself, and this is in the show, to look like, you know, a younger version of herself.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen Jack and Hagar turn into people that are roughly like, you know, a humanoid male. I don't see any evidence that they can do something crazy like masquerade as a dragon or a mammoth or a giant or what have you.
Right.
But, you know, there's also no limitation that says that he can't do that. But no, I, for one, like you said, I believe the Hound's alive and, I don't know. I don't like the idea of Arya going and because there's another thing. I leave this for next week's non-spoiler podcast because it's not particularly spoiling. Nope. Here it is. The last email. Sarah G says, are we assuming the show Faceless Men have different rules from the book Faceless Men? In the books, a faceless person cannot be assigned to kill someone that he or she knows personally. This is a big deal, as it will preclude Arya from being allowed or assigned to kill anyone on her shortened show list, except for Walder Frey, since she has not personally met them. She's met both Cersei and Gregor, so, per the rules of the Order, she wouldn't accept the assignment to kill either of them. Personally, I think she'll eventually won't be able to be no one, and she'll head out on her own, but I don't see everyone theorizing that she would be assigned to kill Cersei or the Mountain by the Faceless Men, since they know of their personal relationship. Assigning Arya to kill anyone on a list would be serving Arya and not the Many-Faced God. Yeah, the whole reason I let that go on is because the show watchers don't know any of that, and they haven't established it. And In fact, Jaqen says, like, a girl has a many names to kill, and she can, like, that's part of his pitch to her, is that she will get to do those things on the show, and they haven't contraindicated it. So
okay.
I do think it's going to be a sticking point that eventually becomes causes her to
leave, maybe.
To become Arya and get the needle and go off on her own. But, you know, I'm not going to... And the other thing is, like, just... The show could run that way. Or, you know, like maybe she does say fuck you to the Faceless Men and the Double D's decide they just want, you know, to have her still be a faceless man and just do away with the rule. I mean, who knows how they can do the right adaptation.
Yeah, it seems like, so I guess I'm surprised there's so much speculation then about, like, her going to kill John, you know, with that idea that he's an abomination or whatever, he's cheated the gods of death.
Well, but most of that stuff is coming from, I think, show watchers.
Okay. Or from, you know, okay, the other thing is,
like,
sense.
It's impossible to keep all the rules of this world in your head when you're theory crafting, so.
Right.
Sometimes the best way to get that out is just
throw it out
it.
There and see if it sticks, yeah.
But yeah, my understanding is that's the case too, and that's what's eventually going to break. But I, you know, who knows what they're going to do on the show. Mm-hmm. And, I let a lot of stuff fly in the non-spoiler section just because, although that's something I try to weed out. Cause every once in a while, like it was really rampant in season three, a lot of quote unquote show watchers were predicting the Red Wedding and
yeah.
there were yeah. signs. But, like, that's one of those things where I'm not, even if you're right, it ain't worth me potentially spoiling everyone's enjoyment of it, you know, just for you to get internet points. So,
yeah.
There's a lot of times where I won't come down on either one side because I don't want to potentially spoil it. It's getting harder for me to tell because some...
And not even mention something if you know that it's going to happen later.
Yeah, and some of the stuff now, it's even a blurrier line. Like, you know, I mean, it's some stuff is obvious. Like, oh, I think that they're going to find some horn that's going to be able to, you know, control dragons. I'm like, okay, we'll just settle down. We'll talk about that in the spoiler edition. But some things are really subtle, and I don't know what to mm-hmm. what to call and what to not. I try to do the best I can. But, you know, even season three, I remember I was able to, like, I wouldn't read the whole theory, but I was able to read the thing that they cited as show evidence of it happening and like asked a question like, did you think this was, or what, you know, what do you think this
right.
is going?
And since I didn't know, I was free
well, that's
to
back
talk
in the Mad Brew
it.
Days, I think.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So but I played the same game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you like my Gravedigger slip into the main cast? That's my favorite thing to do is to throw a blatant spoiler into it, but without context, no one knows.
Right, which I argued was the whole reason we didn't have to keep the Gravedigger shirt to the spoiler people.
Yeah.
And you shot it down, so I'm a little like, oh, okay.
Well, that's what the thing
you,
is.
You're
if,
not worried the about podcast spoilers.
So the spoiler t-shirt, which, by the way, you can get if you go to gravedigger.baldmove.com. It's a shirt commemorating the long run of mildly interesting, the phrase that I used to use many, many times when Jim or Mad Brew would suggest something that may or may not be part of the plot, and I'd say, oh, it's mildly interesting, mm-hmm. to mask my knowledge of the books. And it worked really well, but it's time for it to die, and we've got a t-shirt that commemorates it, and it's got the Hound bearing it. If it didn't have the Hound, if the Hound had a mask on or had his back to us, and it wasn't recognizably easily as the Hound, I wouldn't have a problem. That's why it's like when you said the Book of Strangers, like, well, maybe someone walked through a graveyard and had a complete change of character and heart. You know, I feel like all the book readers were like, ho, but nobody can get that.
Okay. All right.
Said, if it didn't have the Hound's face on it, it would be. But that's the thing. Like, you know, you're not the one getting the emails from people outraged that I'm dropping spoilers, which
so far.
I haven't gotten one.
Good.
This is the first season I haven't had someone outraged that I've spoiled something because some people. Like, that's one of the reasons I felt like talking about the mechanics of the King's Moot is kind of background detail,
mm-hmm.
but there'd be people pissed off that I didn't know it was going to be ship's captains only, or I didn't know it was going to be. So, you know, I just try to rule, like, unless it happened on the show, or, like, the other thing is, like, if it happened 300 years ago and it's not going to be probably dealt with on the show, like, I'll tell you, like, here's the skinny about the Aegon the Conqueror. Or Aegon the Unworthy or whatnot, but... Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't drop, like, Tower of Joy stuff.
No.
Right.
No. So, yeah, like I said, I'm just a man. I'm nobody. I'm no one. All right, so that's the podcast. If you would like to send us email, and you got your own tinfoil, or you got some exceptions with the tinfoil we've been spinning, send it to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. You can also discuss it at our burgeoning forum community. Burgeoning?
Burgeoning,
our Burgundy. Our Burgundy mm-hmm. forum community. They're a little like wine red over at forums.baldmove.com. And that's it for our coverage. We'll be back Sunday night, of course, for an instant take, and then Tuesday for the full podcast, and then the wheel turns over again on Friday when we get to the spoiler section. And we'll see you then. Have a great weekend.